the dog ran away.
What?
Yeah, she snapped her chain.
Oh, no.
There must have been a chipmunk or something. And kids were like, the dog. I was like, oh, no. We have her back, which is, you know, not a low light. Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Today, Dr. Victoria Reynolds Farmer joins us for a conversation about disabilities and humanity in the age of COVID. We hope you will join us in a moment for today's episode. All right, so what's been a highlight for you this week?
I got a couple of highlights. One of them was that all of my revisions for my dissertation were accepted and signed off on, as far as I know, which means they officially are recommended that I be granted the PhD in my field of study. So that was nice.
Just congratulations. That's awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, I got it off to the printer, and now they're sending copies to my school and to my supervisor, and then copy to myself as well. So it'll be nice having that. Also, I had an encouraging conversation this morning with one of my examiners for my defense, and he's helping me kind of navigate some of the waters in terms of figuring out potential ways to look at getting my dissertation published.
Oh, that's great. So it was a good conversation?
It was great. Yeah, part of it was just good catching up with him a little bit, finding out a little bit more about him and his context and teaching. And then he said some encouraging things about my work as well, which I think is always good after having wrestled for so long with not knowing how my work would be received.
Right.
But he also has he has some good thoughts on potential ways to look at getting it published. Of course, nothing's guaranteed. It's all just about getting it submitted and seeing what happens. So, but that was a super encouraging conversation this morning for me.
Nice. That sounds really good.
Yeah. How about for you?
I think for me, the gentle soaking rain for a little over a day was great. Like, there have been some beautiful days on both sides of that with some sunshine and all that. Part of it was I had just transplanted a couple of plants like Saturday morning, one on Friday and then a couple on Saturday morning. And so then for it to just rain for a day, I mean, you couldn't ask for a better transplanting, you know, weather event. So I think, and there's something about the rain. I went for a drive with Jenny in the rain on Saturday night while it was raining. And there's something about the sound of the rain and of course the smell of the rain. I just love it. So
that's great. Any low lights for you this week?
I realized, okay, so, you know, we had finals and then final grades and all that. And I had this moment where I realized that I was not looking forward to being done, not because I didn't want to be done, but because it was like there was all of this stuff that was waiting for me around the corner. Mm. And I
did not feel ready for it.
It's like as soon as I hit submit on the grades, there's no reason that I can't look around the corner anymore. And I just know that there's this monster waiting behind the corner of all of this stuff that I've been putting off. And so instead of feeling release, I feel this like, it's just this intensity of all this stuff to do.
I envy you in some ways because I'm feeling almost the opposite of this odd sense of tension with having nothing.
Oh, how about that?
Like, it's this bizarre...
That makes sense.
It's this bizarre thing of like, whoa, this is the first time in my life that I can remember in a long time where I don't have to work on anything.
Yeah, that's...
And I don't feel great about it. I thought it would be this liberating moment, and it's kind of like, well, what now?
Hmm.
And so I don't know. I mean, and I might have some stuff to do. Like, even then, it's just so weird. So I can see how... In some ways, it's been comforting for you to have the semester to not have to look forward.
Right.
Right. And for me, I thought I would be looking forward when everything were done. And it's like, actually, now I'm like, well, what now? You know,
it reminds me, I told Jenny at some point, I was like, I just can't wait to get through my list. She's like, number one, it's never going to happen.
Yeah.
And number two, you don't even want that actually, right?
Like, no kidding.
You want the things to do. And I think there was probably some wisdom in that.
Well, yeah, I got some prospects, which are good. I've got other research things. I'm like, maybe this is the time for me to start digging into this, you know,
Is there a way, like, do you think there's a sense in which you need to rest?
See, that's what I wonder. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I thought the answer would be yes, like to rest. Like, oh, obviously, why would I want to pick up anything after that long haul of a dissertation work? But now I'm even just days in and I'm feeling like, I don't know, like I might need almost something to work on. Well, and I'm going to have plenty to do. Jill needs help with the kids. I've been absent during the day.
So it's almost like relearning a new way of being you.
Yeah, there's that. But then I kind of, the fire lit under me a little bit with research stuff now. And I'm like, maybe I should just, because it's there, maybe I should just attend to it for a little bit.
Yeah.
And if it fizzles out,
it could be fun. So how about for you? What's a low light been?
Oh, you know, I didn't intend this, but one low light for me was going to be the rain. So I'm sorry. Am I contradicting you now after waxing eloquently about how great the rain is? I don't love the rainy weather. Part of it is that it put a kink in my golf plans.
Oh, sure.
So that's one of it. But no, it also, there's something, I'm totally in agreement with you in terms of just some of the good things that rain brings. But man, it kind of just put me in a bit of a bad mood. I don't know. It's hard to describe. One other low light here, and I won't get into this too much, but you know, I've been becoming more and more aware lately of some of the things floating around social media as it relates to all the COVID things. And it's been a little bit interesting, a little bit frustrating, I guess, in some ways, just to hear some of the dialogue that's going on. And we've been talking about this some on the podcast, but just the polarizing dialogue as it relates to politicizing some of this stuff is just been wearing on me. And it's gotten to the point, I am not this type of person, but it's gotten to the point where when it comes up in conversation, I almost just want to say, let's not talk about it.
That's not like you.
That's not like me at all. Yeah, but there's just something where I'm worn out. I'm just so worn out through some of the politicizing the dialogue. It's not that I don't want to actually talk about the issues. It's just that when we frame it in these political arenas, it just gets exhausting in some ways. That's something that's a bit of a low light, and I'm not sure it's going to stop anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to jump in front of you, but my insight
please.
Is connected to that. So something I was thinking about this week is the pleasure of outrage.
Huh.
And I mentioned it to Jenny. She's like, oh yeah, that kind of has a nice sound to it. Did you come up with that? I was like, well, probably not. You know, probably somebody has thought that thought before. And I looked it up, and sure enough, there's some writing on it. But this idea that being outraged somehow makes us feel good. Because I was trying to figure out, why are people so drawn to being so upset? Like what is good about that? And then trying to think about, okay, what does that look like as a follower of Jesus? What does that look like? And so I've been actually looking forward to asking you about this. So as a reminder of Proverbs 19:11, a person's wisdom yields patience. It's to one's glory to overlook an offense. I'm like, okay, that makes sense like on an individual level, but then kind of at this societal level, where do we go? And I was drawn to Romans. So this is why I always wanted to ask you about it. Anyway, so Romans 12. So in verse 9, love must be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. And I'm like, okay, I could see that being justification for being outraged, right? I'm abhorring what is evil, right? It's right there in the text. But then I'm thinking about the larger context. So in 12:2 is where it talks about not being conformed to the world, but transformed by the renewing of your mind, so you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect. And I was like, okay, so this kind of trying to judge what's good and what's bad and, you know, those kinds of things, like just thinking through that. But then don't think of yourself more highly than you ought is also right there. And then a little bit later, bless those who persecute you, you know, echoing Jesus, you know, bless and do not curse. And then as far as it's possible with you, live peaceably with all, don't avenge yourself. Mm-hmm. God is the avenger, right? Like, and then don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So all of that's right there, right?
Yeah.
So how do we think about that?
Well, you know, one of my favorite people once said, vengeance is mine, says the Lord, but I just want to be about the Lord's business. So we can't help it. No, I like what you're saying there about the Romans passage. There's this sense where we can't frame some of those discussions about abhorring what's evil without understanding the sense of humility that is implicit in the passage, the sense of letting God take care of us not taking vengeance out upon our enemies. And of course, chapter 13 comes right after this, where we're told that actually it's the governing authorities that act as God's avengers. Now, we can't get into all of the complexity.
Because there's a whole other discussion there,
right? But what it's encouraging is to say, like, you don't need to take out vengeance, and you need to be somebody who, on the one hand, abhors evil, but on the other hand, tries to live peaceably. And the way that you're able to do that is because you trust God to take care of the people who wrong you, and God will use the government in some way or form to do that. And again, complex, but that initial passage in 12 about the renewing of one's mind, I think, is key to then getting down to that passage about abhorring what's evil. It's not just our own personal nitpicky things that constitute what's evil. It's the things that have been reshaped around the transforming of our mind. So we're kind of seeing it in some ways, oddly, from a God's eye vantage point, meaning the things that God would deem to be evil, not just the things that are our own nitpicky, you know, distastes and dislikes.
Man, that's such a thick thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Well, we'll have to come back to that.
Well, and maybe that's my insight for this week. because I'm not sure, you know, I'm piggybacking then off of you, but part of what I was also reflecting on related to this is the role that we as academics play in the midst of these different truth universes and different politicizations of the COVID. And we've had these conversations before, but wondering how it is that what we do in terms of research in the academic world can help in some ways to set standards for what constitutes valid source materials. We're not completely exempt from making mistakes in the academic world by any means, but right. We do have certain checks and balances in place with claims that we make that need to have verification, at least along the lines of backing ourselves up with legitimate source materials and whatnot. That doesn't exist in social media.
Right.
And it never will. I'm not hoping that we'll have some academic, you know, sourcing going on in social media. But what it can do is kind of encourage us to find some sort of filtration methods. This is getting back to what Willett shared with us last week. Getting through some filtration methods of discernment in terms of discerning what's true and discerning what aspects are just simply people's opinions and how much of it is founded upon actual research that they've done. I'm not sure we're going to get it right perfectly in the academic world either, but I think we maybe have something to contribute there.
Yeah, that's rich. We'll be right back in a moment with Dr. Victoria Reynolds Farmer.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
We have Victoria Reynolds Farmer with us today. She holds a PhD in literature and gender studies from Florida State University. She's also the co-founder of the Christian Feminist Podcast on the Christian Humanist Radio Network. And she's currently working in community management for an Atlanta startup that supports women entrepreneurs. She lives in the suburb of Atlanta with her husband and their cat. It is so good to see you.
It is great to be here. Thanks so much for having me. I'm real excited to talk. I miss talking to you guys regularly.
Yeah. It's been about a year, I guess, since we've all been in the same room together.
Yeah, I think that's about right, because we've been back in Georgia about a year.
How about that?
And I don't remember your cat's name.
Dorothy Parker, which is...
That's right.
What happens when two literature graduate students get married?
That's great.
Got some, I thought, fascinating questions here that we can talk through today.
So, like, it seems like you've done some advocacy, some posting on Facebook, that kind of thing. So, what's the most natural lead-in for you?
Yeah, sure. So, I came to an interest in disability advocacy. The way a lot of people do, which is I am a disabled person, and that's how I move through the world. I think you'll find that most people involved in disability advocacy either are disabled themselves or have a close friend or relative who has kind of made them more aware of certain inequalities that exist in the world. So I was born with spastic diplegic cerebral palsy. If you talk to a lot of disabled people, you know they can kind of rattle off medical terms pretty easy, because they have to learn how to say those things and advocate for themselves. What that means is cerebral palsy is a muscular disorder caused by damage to the part of the brain that deals with muscle control. And the spastic diplegic part means that it affects my legs and makes them, essentially the muscles are too tight, tighter than an able-bodied person's leg muscles would be. So I really just kind of, in moving through the world, realized eventually that my experience of little things, things like buildings I could enter or buildings I couldn't enter, situations where I would have to ask for help or kind of be made an example of where other people wouldn't, I started to realize that my life was different in those kinds of ways. And in some cases, it started to seem unfair or like I was being treated less than. So I found the activist community really kind of late in life, not really until college. And social media has been a big deal for me in terms of connecting with other people who have similar experiences and really making me realize, you know, I'm not crazy. Some of this stuff that has happened to me that isn't easy to brush off shouldn't be easy to brush off, because it's not, it's not equitable. It's not the right way to treat people. So that's a little long-winded, I guess, but that's kind of how I very slowly came to advocacy. Though I wouldn't call I'm not like a professional activist or anything. I just kind of try to speak from my experience the best I can in a way that is teaching people rather than criticizing people. Though
gotcha.
Some people need to be criticized.
So one of the things that we were talking about, Justin and I were talking about as we were getting ready for this week, is just realizing that we've heard about how COVID has affected different populations, but we have not heard very much about the impact on disabled peoples, right? Like, I think the main thing that I've been aware of is I saw something about masks that with a see-through thing for people who do lip reading. But that's kind of all I've really heard about. Does that fit for you, Justin? Have you heard much?
No, I haven't heard much at all.
So that's one of the things I think we were really interested, you know, with your connections and the conversations you're in. What are the rest of us missing?
The big thing for me has been, and that kind of, I talked about social media. One of the things that's been going on social media, there has been a hashtag conversation that started a few years ago, started by an activist named Imani Barberin, who, if you don't follow, you should, if you're interested in this conversation. She started a hashtag ableds are weird. And just talking about like assumptions that able-bodied people make about disabled people or people with disabilities that kind of show ingrained prejudice or ingrained ableism. And this hashtag went away for a while, but it came back right around the time the virus hit because of this explosion of remote working opportunities. And like every meeting is on Zoom now, and people are saying, you know, it really does take a long time to use public transportation, so let's not do that. And the hashtag came back because people with disabilities, you know, have been asking for remote working accommodations for decades since the internet started to exist, and have been told in droves, you know, it's not easy for our company to do that. It's too complicated.
And this would be under the reasonable accommodation requirement under the ADA, is that right?
Yes. So maybe we can take a pause and talk about the ADA for a second.
Yeah.
I'll come back to that. But yes, so I'll just talk about the ADA and then circle back. So you mentioned reasonable accommodations, which is a phrase that comes from the beginning of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a civil rights law passed in, I wrote it down, 1990, July 26th, 1990. When I want to freak people out about the disability experience, the first place I start is the ADA is younger than me.
it sounded really late when you said that. In my mind, it's older than that. I did not realize it was that
No, young. It's not. When I was born, those civil rights did not exist for me, at least in the law.
Wow.
But the ADA says that corporations, companies, public buildings are required by law to offer quote unquote reasonable accommodation to people with disabilities, which usually means issues of accessibility, of access, that you can enter places and participate in events, that any barriers to you doing those things should be removed by law by the place putting them on, that it's not sort of on you to arrange for those things. It's on the company or corporation or building or whatever to make sure those things are done for you. So when all this remote working started happening because of the virus, a lot of people with disabilities were pretty upset because it seemed like, you know, this was way too hard when we were asking for it, even though this is written into the law. But now, you know, a bunch of able-bodied people need it. And like, sure, let's just hop on a Zoom. It's fine.
So it's one more area where what was impossible is suddenly not only possible, but common. And it seems like what was missing was willpower.
Right. You know, now that a larger group of people understand that it can be an inconvenience.
Are there any ways that you've noticed that the virtual work environment has presented challenges for folks with disabilities? You mentioned, you know, some of the benefits where people who had disabilities have wanted to be able to work virtually or be able to have accommodations that maybe weren't previously there. But what are some of the challenges maybe that exist in trying to work virtually now?
These are not things that I have experienced personally just because of the type of disability I have. But I have, for example, friends in the chronic pain community who have talked about issues with Zoom meetings and time zones. If you have flare-ups or pain issues, medication issues that disturb sleep or whatever, it can be difficult to connect with people who are in different time zones. Other things, people in the deaf and blind communities have been talking about accessibility in online work in terms of descriptive audio or captioning. Lots of places that say they have accessible media just run their audio through a caption feature not controlled by a person, which can be less useful in some cases.
Yeah, that makes sense that would be problematic.
Because I think most people think of these measures as stopgaps and not as the thing I need to communicate. I think if more people thought of them as, you know, the way someone is going to get information, then maybe it would be not as hastily thrown together in some cases.
So it sounds like in some ways I'm not sure how to put it, but it's almost like this sudden rush to one type of accommodation has revealed or maybe put the highlight, has shown a light again on how much society doesn't, I'm not sure how to put it. It's like it reveals how much we don't care well for people with disabilities. And then that's proven by, it's demonstrated by the lack of additional care for things like how we're transcribing audio. Is that right?
I think so. I mean, I don't want to sound wholly negative because I am, like, it is pretty wild and exciting to see things that I talk about and think about and am excited about all the time start to break into a broader public consciousness. Like, I'm happy that that's happening. It is interesting to see kind of the margins move to the center a little bit in terms of, like, you know, these are conversations that I have been having with people who also have them for decades. And now, like, now lots of other people are having them too. And while it's a positive, it's also like, what took you so long to get here? Like, why did you not realize or listen, you know, to the right people in the right places? Why did you not realize that this has actually been a thing for a really long time?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is interesting how some of these things people are discovering for the first time. I had a Zoom account years ago. I had a Zoom account long enough that I had unsubscribed for Zoom like 2 years before this whole thing happened. Like, it's not like this stuff is new, but our rush to it is new.
I would say it has to be frustrating too, to see things that could become positive developments, but that are primarily, that primarily derive from the inconveniences of able-bodied people, rather than from theoretical foundations for caring for folks who have already been experiencing some of the difficulties of trying to work in the environments that we're requiring them to. So how much of it is it, can you celebrate the fact that maybe some big changes are coming? And in what other ways is it just frustrating? Because it's like, this could have happened long ago. And the reason it's happening now seems to be for not necessarily positive theoretical reasons, but for necessity because of how it's just impacting, you know, people in a COVID era.
I mean, that's hard, because the cynical side of me just wants to say, like, well, this is the way it's been forever. Like, not, it doesn't shock me that this is what it took. The thing that I think I'm most excited about in terms of these conversations getting broader traction is that lots of people are starting to turn to disabled voices for solutions. Mm. Activists inside the community, I feel like I'm talking so much about Twitter hashtags, but Twitter has been important for us, especially if you get, you know, a huge group of people who can't move around for various reasons. Social media can be a way to congregate and kind of have one voice. But there is another hashtag that activists have been rallying around, which is hashtag nothing about us without us, which that idea means that you need to consult people with disabilities when making disability policy, which sounds very simple, but is not often actually done. So people are asking questions of disabled folks themselves and saying, like, what problems do you have taking public transportation? What problems do you have holding down a job? Something that a lot of people don't know is that when you look at the unemployment rate any given year, if you segment out for disabled people, at least I know in 2018 and 2019 this was true, the employment rate doubles if you just drill down and look at disability. So there's a lot of there are a lot of companies that are excluding a large portion of the population in terms of making it easy to get to work, do the work you're hired to do, and a lot of people just aren't aware that those barriers exist socially until you actually talk to the people who are dealing with them every day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What would you like to see, or what would you hope to see from Jesus followers, from Christians, you know, in relation to the disabled experience, the disabled experience with the whole pandemic?
We should all think about using phrases like the disabled experience, because that, you know, disabled people are a quarter of the United States population. If you include everything, physical, mental, and invisible disabilities. Mm. So, like all groups of people, we are not a monolith. No group is a monolith. So
right.
Realize that those experiences vary really, really widely. What I would want from Christians first and foremost is to, one, ask the person that you're talking to about their experience. And then when they tell you, believe them. Because I've been in so many situations where I've said, I feel excluded by this policy or this sermon or this whatever. Let me give an example. that is specific. I hate the hymn, Take My Life and Let It Be. It's a very pretty song, but from the time I was a child, the idea of feet being swift and beautiful for God ripped my heart out a little bit. Because my feet are neither swift nor beautiful, nor will they ever be. And just that, hearing that kind of ableist metaphor embedded in a common way of talking about taking the gospel to people, that was just another really tiny way that I felt like, as a child, the community that was supposed to be most supportive of me as a divinely created person made in the image of God was, you know, saying without even thinking about it, you matter a little bit less than the rest of us do. And you know, that wasn't on purpose. I was raised by a great congregation of people who loved me and cared for me and helped me a lot and worked really hard to make sure my experience was as like other children's experiences as it could possibly be. So this is not, I'm not criticizing individual people or communities, but I'm saying that those ingrained prejudices are ingrained in ways that sometimes you can't see unless they affect you directly or you're looking for them. So I really would like Christians to be more perceptive of little things like that. And I think that comes primarily from, like I said, listening to people's experiences and believing them when they tell you how they experience the world.
I've noticed similar parallels too with the idea of gendered language, both in hymns and in Bible translations and whatnot. And I've come across these attitudes among students sometimes, which is like, well, I just don't see what the big deal is, right? Like, and so talking about the ways that metaphors that we use in our hymns, the way that we translate our scriptures, which can become exclusive and excluding certain folks, It's not just a matter, I think, of the attitude that some of our students have, which is, well, I don't see what the big deal is. It's a matter of justice and a matter even of trying to discern how certain people can feel deeply hurt and left out in light of the ways that we've kind of haphazardly not taken those things into consideration. And so I try to encourage our students, you know, in their academic writing and in the ways that we're reading the scriptures to be aware of those things. But those are hard tendencies, I think, to break.
They are. And it's, I'm not trying to say that, you know, everyone should use the language that I use. There's differences in language preferences, even within the disability community. But I am saying that, you know, it is important to kind of deconstruct those systems, particularly when Christianity is about accepting and loving people. And it's about the big thing for me, the thing that is really pushing me toward my own theology of disability, which I've tried to develop as an adult, is the idea of worshiping an incarnational Christ and what that means for me as someone who inhabits a disabled body. Because I grew up in a really low church Protestant tradition. I was raised Southern Baptist. And again, not criticizing those individual people or my church who, by and large, loved me very well. But I didn't really get I didn't see myself in the lessons that we were learning in Sunday school. All the disability parables just kind of make you feel like the before picture in the ad for Jesus's miracles, right? Like you're not the, you're not the result of that.
Wow. That's a really hard way to put that. Wow. Like, is that's the way that it felt to you sometimes? Like,
oh, sure. Yeah. You know, you're the blind man before I, not that I am blind, but the disabled person is the blind man before the mud goes and
before
his
the
eyes
healing,
and,
right?
you know, I remember people talking to me all the time when I was a kid saying that, like, you know, won't it be so great when you get to heaven because your body will be perfect. That's well-meaning, but also when you say it to a child, that child hears, everything will be great once you're dead.
Oh man.
You know, there's no appreciation for the complexity of your life now, which to me, like,
right,
the incarnation has that complexity. Christ took on a flawed human body that felt pain. And I've got to think, I love to think that he did so much of his ministry with disabled people because he understood the messiness of embodiment, which is one reason I mentioned earlier that I was raised in kind of a lower church tradition. I'm now in the process of becoming Catholic. And one thing that really, really drew me strongly to Catholic tradition and theology is the centrality of the incarnation to the sacraments, not just the doctrine of transubstantiation and that literal physicality, though that is one thing, but things like the sacrament of anointing the sick, the idea that we begin every prayer by physically marking ourselves as Christian through the sign of the cross. Because I grew up in a theological tradition that rightly or wrongly made me feel that my body was an impediment to my spirituality, this kind of Gnosticism or separation of those two things.
Right.
And something that I love about Catholic theology is that I am a spiritual being in the sacraments, not despite of my physicality, but through it and because of it.
That's really beautiful.
I was listening to one of your episodes on the Christian Feminist podcast, and I heard you share a little story about seeing Nadia Bolz-Weber speak in Minneapolis and the impact that her message had on you when it came to incarnational theology. Without having to rehash all of that, because I think our listeners could check out your podcast. What was it about that moment when you saw her speak that really spoke to you in terms of this concept of incarnational theology?
So disclaimer, there are a lot of things about Nadia's current theology that I very, very disagree with. So this is not an endorsement of everything that she believes. But I did see her preach a Eucharistic sermon at the first Y Christian meeting in Minneapolis in 2015. And I'll never forget one thing that she said in that sermon, which was all about embodiment. She said, I had a hard time for a long time hearing good news about my body until I learned that the good news had a body. Mm-hmm. So this idea that the gospel is Christ and Christ was incarnated, and therefore, you know, we need to have the love for our physical bodies that Christ did and does.
There was a Time Magazine article recently about, it profiles Alice Wong. Can you tell us maybe a little bit about what that article was communicating about disability experiences in COVID?
Yes. Alice Wong is one of my favorite activists. She runs a podcast called Disability Visibility, which you should check out. And Alice has a disability which necessitates that she uses a ventilator every day, all the time, to live. And one of the really interesting parts of that article, which is primarily about the ways in which disabled people have been, because of coronavirus, separated from lots of accommodations they need to live, like aides and helpers, and in some cases, assistance animals. But in Alice's case, she talks about being told, you know, if you are ill with the virus or with something else, your ventilator, which again, she needs to be alive every day, will be taken from you because you are lower priority than a healthier person who has coronavirus.
Jeez.
And I mean, as a human being, that is despicable, but as a human being who is a follower of Christ, like, how can that happen to people? Like, you're stripping her of her worth and dignity and saying, you know, healthier bodies have more value, more quality of life than you do. And then that's horrible. I mean, I know and have talked to Alice a little bit. We both used to work in public radio. So we started trading messages a little bit, and you know, it's sad because she's a great person, and her voice is important to the community, but it's also just sad because she is a human, and right. Humans should never be treated like that. It's appalling. Appalling, but not terribly surprising.
So some of those things that we were talking about earlier, it's not just a question of inconvenience or a question of sadness of having been told, no, these aren't reasonable accommodations, and then suddenly finding out, yeah, they probably were. It's, this goes really deep, right? Down to core visions of humanity.
And worth. Who is worth the care of society and who is not?
So that leads to this other question. And I don't know if you have time for this. So feel free to reject it if we need to come back to it another time. But last week, Justin and I were talking about Jean Vanier, who has... So I think you know where this is going, right? He's helped shape my view of disability, right? Which obviously still needs more shaping. But yeah, in terms of understanding Christ in disability, you know, and all this. And then, you know, also we find out about his abusive relationships with people. Do you have time to help us think about that a little bit?
Not enough time. I will say, like, I am still very angry about that. I feel betrayed by it, I guess, is the best word I can use to honestly convey my thought process. Because I mean, I've been reading about him for a really long time. I used to say very often that I'd love to retire to a large community or a similar place, because I think that kind of normalizing that kind of interdependence on both sides is, in many ways, what Christian living should look like.
Right.
Also, I think it points to the ways prejudice and oppression are so often so intersectional that you can't untangle one kind from another. I mean, there's sort of abled prejudice there, but there's gender issues too.
Right.
I was talking to a friend, and she and I were talking, and she said, like, man, there's nothing that straight white men can't mess up for us. And I laughed, and that's funny, but I do think that there's a grain of truth to the fact that, like, no matter how much you are aware of certain kinds of privilege that you might have, no one is privileged in just one way, just as no one is marginalized in just one way. And these things come together in these really difficult matrices that it's kind of hard to get out from under because of the ways prejudice is systemic. So yeah, I don't know. That's not an answer. I'm really upset about it. it makes me sad. It still makes me sad. Mm-hmm. But I still want to hold value in all the good that he did. Mm-hmm. And I think it's possible to, I mean, I think it's possible to look at those communities that are still going on and still putting good in the world and still forwarding a more human understanding of what it is to be and to live alongside disabled people. And all of those are goods that we shouldn't let a person's sin necessarily take away. But we should also hold people in power positions accountable for their power and mm-hmm. how they use it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were tossing around just thoughts about heroism too, and how people turn certain figures in public into heroes, and how we can just kind of flip the narrative and villainize them. And it's just become so tricky when we hold them up to this certain standard. And I'm not at all wanting to dismiss anything that Jean Vanier had done, because if anything, I think it's a warning to us about creating heroes in that way, because we should be able to celebrate human capacity, achievement, and contribution without turning them into heroes, running the danger, of course, that we're creating people that don't even exist. But at the same time, we cannot turn a blind eye to what we're learning about him and justify it simply because he's, you know, said some good things over the years. It's that troubling thing to try to wrestle with.
Yeah. And I think the part of that that was the most hard for me, and I think the first thing I said when I found out, and I found out pretty quickly because I got tweeted at or texted or emailed by everyone. And I said, like, man, we get so few people. Like, there are so few people on our team in terms of mm-hmm. like, we're already dealing with a stack deck. It's such a small percentage of people who know how to do this thing and do it right. And now, like, someone who was one of those people, like, that's taken away too.
Yeah, that's awful.
Well, I really appreciate you being with us today, Victoria. I feel like we just barely scratched the surface on several topics.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. It has been a blast. Thanks for letting me talk about a lot of things I really love to talk about. And it was just great to hang out with you guys again. I miss you both so much.
Yeah, I miss you too.
It was really fun. That was really good talking with Victoria.
Yeah, I miss the fact that we're not able to meet together in person here lately since their move to Georgia, but it was great mm-hmm. catching up with her.
Yeah, I was really glad to be able to ask her about Vanier there at the end, because, like, one of the things that I learned about from Vanier, I think in high school, I volunteered at a camp for a couple of weeks for kids who had disabilities. And so that was a really moving experience for me. I hope that it was a good experience for the campers. But then my senior year of high school, I had the opportunity to work in a special needs classroom for 1 hour a day, one of my semesters in my senior year of high school. And that was really just, it was just good. And I didn't know why. And then Vanier put that into some words for me, you know, just this idea of ways in which if we see disability not as some kind of a dysfunction or not as some kind of a lack, but see whole people, right? And I think that that's one of the things that Vanier brought, was this idea of these people are whole, right? There's, which is part of why what Victoria was talking about in the idea of, okay, because you're less abled, your life is worth less, right, than somebody who is able-bodied. Oh man, like, the understanding that the dignity of the human person, not because of what they produce. Right. And I think Vanier put that into some words for me that were really, really good. And then sometime in my life, I don't know when, I remember somebody introducing the idea of being temporarily abled, and that you could use that as an identifier, right? That I'm temporarily abled, which actually even just my recent sprained ankle is a reminder, right? Of how quickly some of those things can change. And we don't know, you know, but to not take ability for granted.
Yeah. I went through kind of a painful experience with a family member when about the time that I first encountered Vanier's work, and my brother was diagnosed with MS in his early 20s. And he had started to see this sort of slow progression of him losing his balance and not knowing what's going on. And, you know, I'm just seeing him have to go through, you know, wrestling what that might mean for his life as a 20-year-old, and initially having a walker and handicap parking pass and all those things, and having to make those adjustments. You know, Vanier's work, I think, helped me process through some of what I was seeing my brother have to go through without being able to experience any of that myself. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, I have so many mixed thoughts about hearing the news of everything that went down with him. Yeah. I'm still valuing.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's the kind of thing that's easy to stumble over the details of, but
it is. Yeah.
But I think, like we were talking about last week, it's so important to not be dismissive of what he did, that he abused people.
Yeah.
Right. That he took advantage of his position
in some deeply disturbing and troubling ways that make you wonder, well, how could he say these things and then do those things?
Right.
And that's what's hard to wrestle with. It's something we've seen in preaching environments too over the years. And I had a painful experience with a pastor, you know, in my own experience, that I really looked up to, and I know you and I have talked about this before and in various circumstances in our lives where we've encountered that. And it's always been a challenge to me thinking about being a teacher and being a professor, where we want to constantly speak the truth, but we know we're all failures, you know, and yet there's something that's just, it's hard to not feel the pain when we hear things coming out of someone's mouth on one side and then a completely different setting in their life. But it, to some extent, I keep thinking to myself, you know, I don't even know how to sift through this. You know, every time that we speak of the gospel, we're all hypocrites in some ways, without dismissing the deeply troubling nature of those who say one thing and do another, that are in such contradiction that it's just deeply wrong.
I think the other thing that it does is it's a reminder of a couple of things. One of the things it reminds me of is that so sometimes I think when we think about living rightly, right, you know, be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect, I think that it's easy to get lost in, I need to be righteous for my sake. And I think if that's it, right? If it's just, I need to be righteous for my sake, then I think it becomes kind of easy to justify certain things, right? Yeah. Well, this isn't a problem for me. But then you'll know these passages better than I do, but you know, some of the things to recognize how I live affects my brothers and sisters, right? It affects people way beyond me. It affects the witness to the gospel of Christ. Like my own righteousness is not just about me. It affects so many other people, which means I need to be really honest about the source of my righteousness, right? Like my righteousness, I am not righteous. Jesus is righteous. And at the same time, how I live now matters. I need to be very, very aware of the temptation to justify things that actually hurt people.
Yeah, there's, you're getting a lot of theological richness there in that distance sometimes that exists between the reality of who we are in Christ and then the actuality of how our lives are lived out on a daily basis. It's theological circles, we call it justification and sanctification. And we don't want to dismiss the sanctifying process that we all have to go through. And we don't want to, and I think I've even been accused by students, even this semester, of emphasizing the messiness of sanctification, which can lead to this sort of almost fatalism of like, well, we're just never going to be able to live righteous then on this side. And I want to be cautious of that, right? Because like there is this hope too. There's this hope of like, well, we're in process and we're not perfect, but we can see growth, right? We can actually grow. And it's not so that we can hold our righteousness up and say, hey, take a look at me. It's just because it's God's work in our life. But in the same sense, I'm deeply aware of the not yet component of that sanctification.
but there is a sense in which Paul said, follow me as I follow Christ, right? Like,
yeah.
That we should be living a life that's worthy of emulation.
Yeah. And that's, that's a hard question to think about personally sometimes. Mm-hmm. Living a life worthy of emulation, especially because, anyhow, I guess there's more I'd have to think about on that too, but...
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. We couldn't fit our whole conversation with Victoria here, so watch for a special compilation episode about church coming soon. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. We hope you can join us for coffee again next week.